and intelligent expression. Her stare was nothing like that of an animal, and Artyom could not immediately be sure that someone else was not studying him carefully through her eyes. But the cat yawned, stretching out her sharp pink tongue and burying her muzzle in her bedding, dropped back to sleep, like an illusion that had vanished.
But why don't they want people to know about them?
Artyom remembered his question.
There are two reasons for that. First of all, the sheep are guilty of having rejected their shepherds at their moment of weakness. Second, since the Metro II was cut off from our world, the shepherds have developed differently from us, and are no longer human, but beings of a higher order, whose logic is incomprehensible to us, and whose thoughts are inaccessible. No one knows what they think of our Metro, but they could change everything, even return us to our wonderful lost world, because they have regained their former power. Because we rebelled against them once and betrayed them, they no longer have anything to do with our fate. However, the shepherds are everywhere, and our every breath is known to them, every step, every blow, everything that happens in the Metro. They only observe for the present, and only when we atone for our dreadful sin will they turn to us with a gracious gaze and extend a hand to us. And then, a renaissance will begin. That is what those who believe in the unseen watchers say.
He fell silent, inhaling the aromatic smoke.
But how can people atone for their guilt?
Artyom asked.
Nobody knows, except the unseen watchers themselves. Humans don't understand it, because they do not know the dispensation of the watchers.
Then people might never be able to atone for their sin against them.
Artyom was baffled.
Does that bother you?
Yevgeny Dmitrievich shrugged his shoulders and blew two more big, beautiful smoke rings, one slipping through the second. There was silence for a time, at first light and limpid, but gradually getting thicker and louder and more palpable. Artyom felt a growing need to break it any way he could, with any senseless phrase, even a meaningless sound.
And where are you from? He asked.
Before I lived at Smolenskaya, not far from the metro, about 5 minutes' walk,
Yevgeny Dmitrievich replied, and Artyom stared at him in surprise. How could he have lived not far from the metro? He must have meant that he lived not far from a metro station in a tunnel, right?
You had to walk past food stalls. We sometimes bought beer there, and there were always prostitutes standing around near the stalls, and the police had a headquarters there.
Yevgeny Dmitrievich continued, and Artyom had started to realize that he was talking about the old times, about what had gone on before.
Yeah, me too. I also live not far from there, at Kalinsky, in the high-rise, said Sergei Andreevich. Someone told me about 5 years ago that he'd heard from a stalker that they had crumbled to dust. The house of books is still there, and all the cheap paperbacks were sitting on the tables untouched. Can you believe it? And all that was left of the high-rise was a pile of dust and blocks of cement. Strange.
So what was life like back then?
Artyom was curious. He loved to ask old men this question, and they would stop whatever they were doing and describe the old days with such pleasure. Their eyes would assume a dreamy, distant look. Their voices would sound totally different, and their faces looked 10 years younger. Images of the past which were brought to life before their mind's eyes were nothing like the pictures that Artyom conjured up while they told their stories. But it was nonetheless very enjoyable for all. It was sort of sweet and sort of torturous at the same time, and it made the heart ache.
Well, you see, it was a wonderful time. Back then, we were on fire,
Yevgeny Dmitrievich replied, drawing out his answer. Here, Artyom definitely did not imagine what the gray-haired man had in mind, and when the other old man realized that, he quickly elucidated.
We were very lively. We had good times. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. We were on fire,
Yevgeny Dmitrievich confirmed.
I had a green Moskvich 2141, and I'd spent my whole salary to buy it, to give it a sound system, to change the oil. Once, like a fool, I even had the carburetor replaced with a sports car model, and then I used nitrous oxide.
He had clearly transported himself to those good old days when you could so easily get an old sports car carburetor to put in your car, and his face took on that same dreamy expression that Artyom so loved. It was a shame that Artyom understood little of what he was saying there.
Artyom probably doesn't even know what a Moskvich is, never mind what a carburetor is.
Sergei Andreevich interrupted his friend's sweet reminiscences.
What do you mean he doesn't know?
The thin man threw Artyom an angry look. Artyom took to studying the ceiling, gathering his thoughts.
So, why are you burning books?
He changed the subject as a counter-offensive tactic.
We've already read them,
Yevgeny Dmitrievich responded.
There's no truth in books, Sergei Andreevich added in explanation. Anyway, perhaps you should tell us something about how you're dressed. Are you a member of a cult or what?
Yevgeny Dmitrievich delivered a decisive blow.
No, no, of course not,
Artyom hurried to explain, but they did pick me up and help me when I was in trouble. He explained in broad strokes in what poor shape he'd been, but didn't go so far as explaining quite how bad it was.
Yes, yes, that's exactly how they work. I recognize the tactics. Orphaned and wretched. Or something in that vein.
Nodded Yevgeny Dmitrievich.
You know, I was at one of their meetings and they say very strange things,
said Artyom.
I stood around for a while and listened, but couldn't stand it very long. For example, that Satan's principal wickedness was that he wanted glory and adoration for himself. Two. Before, I thought it had been a lot more serious, but it just turned out to be jealousy. Is the world really so simple? And does everything revolve around the fact that someone didn't want to share glory and worshippers?
The world is not that simple,
Sergei Andreevich assured him, taking the hookah from the fair-haired smoker and inhaling.
And one more thing. They say that God's principal qualities are his mercy, kindness, and willingness to forgive, and that he's a God of love, and that he's all-powerful. At the same time, the first time man disobeyed him, he was kicked out of paradise and made a mortal. So then a whole lot of people die. Not scary. And in the end, God sends his son to save everyone. And then his son dies a horrible death and calls out to God before he dies, asking why God had forsaken him. And all this is for what? To purge with his blood the sin of the first human, who God had himself provoked and punished, and so that people could return to paradise and again discover immortality? It's some kind of pointless baloney, because he could have just not punished everyone so severely to begin with for stuff they didn't do. Or he could have discontinued the punishment because the offense had taken place so long ago. But why sacrifice your beloved son, and even betray him? What kind of love is that? What kind of willingness to forgive? Where's the omnipotence?
Roughly and bluntly stated, but correct in general terms,
said Sergei Andreevich approvingly, passing the hooker to his companion.
Here's what I can say on the subject,
said Yevgeny Dmitrievich, filling his lungs with smoke and smiling blithely. He paused for a minute and then continued.
So, if their god indeed has some qualities or distinguishing aspects, they certainly don't include love or justice or forgiveness, judging from what's happened on Earth from the time it was, created, only one kind of love has been unique to God. He loves interesting stories. First he sets up an interesting situation, and then he stands back to see what happens. If the result is a little flat, he adds a little pepper. So old man Shakespeare was right. All the world's a stage, just not the one he was hinting at, he concluded. This morning alone you've talked your way into several centuries in hell, observed Sergei Andreevich. That means you'll have someone to talk with there,
Yevgeny Dmitrievich told his companion.
On the other hand, many interesting acquaintances may be made there, said Sergei Andreevich. For example, among the upper hierarchy of the Catholic Church. Yes, they are surely there, yet strictly speaking, so are ours.
Both of Artyom's companions clearly didn't much believe that there would someday be a reckoning for everything said now. But Yevgeny Dmitrievich's words about how what has happened to humanity is just an interesting story, led Artyom to a new thought.
Now, I've read a good many different books, he said, And I'm always amazed that they are nothing like real life. I mean, look, events in books are arranged in a nice straight line. Everything is tied to everything else. Causes have effects, and nothing doesn't just happen. But in reality, everything's completely otherwise. I mean, life is just full of senseless events that happen to us randomly, and there's no such thing as everything happening in a logical sequence. What's more, books, for example, come to an end just where the logical chain breaks off. There's a beginning, a development, then a peak, and an end.
A climax, not a peak, Sergei Andreevich corrected him, listening to Artyom's observations with a bored look. Evgeny Dmitrievich also did not evince any particular interest. He moved the smoking apparatus closer to himself, inhaled some aromatic smoke, and held his breath.
Okay, climax, continued Artyom, slightly discouraged. But in life, everything's different. First, a logical chain might not come to an end, and second, even if it does, nothing comes to a close because of it.
You mean to say that life has no plot?
Asked Sergei Andreevich, helping Artyom formulate his words. Artyom thought for a moment, then nodded.
But do you believe in fate?
Asked Sergei Andreevich, inclining his head to the side and examining Artyom studiously, while Yevgeny Dmitrievich turned away from the hooker with interest.
No,
said Artyom decisively. There is no fate, just random events that happen to us. And then we make things up on our own later.
Too bad, too bad,
sighed Sergei Andreevich disappointedly, austerely looking at Artyom over his eyeglasses.
Now I'm going to present a little theory of mine to you, and you see for yourself if it matches your life or not. It seems to me that life, of course, is an empty joke, and that there's no purpose to it at all, and that there's no fate, which is to say, anything explicit and definite along the lines of you're born and you already know that you're going to be a cosmonaut or ballerina, or that you'll die in your infancy. No, not like that. While you're living your allotted time, how do I explain this? It may happen that something happens to you that forces you to perform specific actions and make specific decisions, keeping in mind you have free will and can do this or that. But if you make the right decision, then the things that happen to you subsequently are no longer just random, to use your word, events. They're caused by the choices that you made. I don't intend to say that if you decided to live on the red line before it went communist, that you'd be stuck there and that corresponding events would happen to you. I'm talking of more subtle matters. But if you again were to find yourself at the crossroads and once more made the needed decision, then later you will be faced with a choice that will no longer seem random to you if, of course, you realize and can understand it. And your life will gradually stop being just a collection of random events. It will turn into a plot, I suppose, where everything is connected by some logical, though not necessarily straight, links. That will be your fate. At a certain stage, if you have traveled sufficiently far along your way, your life will have turned into a plot to the extent that strange things will occur that are unexplainable from the point of view of naked rationalism, or your theory of random events. Yet they will fit very well into the logic of the plot line that your life has by then turned into. I think fate doesn't just happen. You need to arrive at it. And if the events in your life come together and start to arrange themselves into a plot, then it may cast you quite far. It is most interesting that a person may not even suspect that this is happening to him, or may conceive what has happened based on a false premise, by attempting to systematize events to match his own worldview. But fate has its own logic.
The strange theory, which at first seemed to Artyom to be complete mumbo-jumbo, suddenly forced him to look at everything that had happened to him from the very beginning, when he had agreed to Hunter's proposal to leave for Polis, from a new point of view. Now all of his adventures, all his travels, which he had previously viewed as unsuccessful and desperate attempts to achieve the goal of his quest, which he pursued wherever it led him, appeared before him in a different light, and it seemed to him to be an elaborately organized system that formed an ornate yet well-thought-out structure. Because if one considered Artyom's acceptance of Hunter's proposal as the first step along the way, as Sergei Andreevich had said,
than all subsequent events, including the expedition to Rishkaya, and the fact that Bourbon approached him at Rishkaya, and that Artyom didn't recoil from him, constituted the next step, and that Khan came to meet him, although he could have remained at Sukharevskaya. Yet this could be explained some other way as well. At any rate, Khan himself cited completely different reasons for his actions. Then Artyom was taken prisoner by the fascists at Tverskaya, and should have been hanged. But circumstances so arranged themselves that the International Brigade decided to attack Tverskaya precisely on that day. Had the revolutionaries shown up a day earlier or a day later, Artyom's death would have been unavoidable, and then his quest would be ended. Could it actually be that the persistence with which he pursued his path influenced future events? Could it be that the determination, rage, and desperation that drove him to take every next step created in some unknown way a reality that wove a set of chaotic events and someone's thoughts and actions into an ordered system, thereby turning an ordinary life into a plot, as Sergei Andreevich had said? At first glance, nothing of the sort could happen, but if he thought about it, how else did one explain the meeting with Mark, who offered Artyom the single possible way of getting into the Hansa territory? And the main thing, the very main thing, is that while he was accepting his lot, cleaning out toilets, fate, it would seem, turned away from him. But when he took the bit between his teeth without even trying to understand his actions, the impossible happened. The guard who was supposed to stay at his post disappeared somewhere, and there wasn't even any pursuit. So when he returned from the diverging crooked path back onto his way, acting in harmony with the narrative pattern of his life, at the stage where he was now, this could already have resulted in a serious warping of reality, repairing it in such a way that the main line of Artyom's fate could develop further, without hindrance. Then this must mean that, should he deviate from his goal or step off his path, fate would immediately abandon him and its invisible shield, which currently safeguarded Artyom from being killed, would directly crumble into pieces, and the thread of Ariadne that he was so carefully following would break, and he would be left face to face with the turbulent reality that had been infuriated with his impudent intrusions into the chaotic substance of reality. Might it be that whoever once attempted to deceive fate and was flippant enough to continue to persevere even after dire clouds had gathered overhead couldn't just simply step off the path? From then on, his life would turn into something completely commonplace and grey, and nothing else would ever happen that was unusual, magical, or unexplainable, because the plot had been interrupted, and he'd put paid to the hero business. Did this mean that Artyom not only hadn't the right, but couldn't deviate from his path? That was his fate. The fate in which he did not believe, and in which he did not believe because he didn't know to interpret what had happened to him, didn't know how to read the signs posted along the road, and continued to naively believe that the road that led to far horizons, and which had been constructed just for him, was a jumbled tangle of abandoned pathways that led in different directions? It seemed that he was proceeding along his path, and that the events of his life formed a harmonious plot that held sway over human will and reason, so that his enemies were blinded, while his friends saw the light and were able to help him in time. It was a plot that so controlled reality that the immutable laws of probability obediently changed their shape, like putty, in response to the growing power of an invisible hand that moved him over the chessboard of life. And if it were actually so, then the question, what's the point of all this, which previously could be answered only with sullen silence and gritted teeth, went away. Now the courage with which he professed to himself, and stubbornly maintained to others, that there was no providence or any higher plan, that there was no law and no justice in the world, turned out to be unnecessary, because that plan could be divined. He did not want to resist this thought. It was too seductive to turn away from it with the same die-hard stubbornness with which he had rejected the explanations offered by religions and ideologies. As a whole, this meant only one thing. "I can't stay here any longer," said Artyom, and got up, feeling as if his muscles were filling with a new buzzing strength. "I can't stay here any longer," he repeated, listening attentively to his own voice. "I have to go. I must." No longer constantly twisting his head around and having forgotten all the fears that drove him to this small fire, He jumped onto the tracks and moved ahead into the darkness. Artyom's doubts released him, making room for perfect peace and the confidence that he was finally doing everything right. It was as if, having been driven off course, he nevertheless was able to recover his feet on the shining rails of his fate. The ties on which he walked now almost passed under his feet by themselves, requiring no effort on his part. In an instant, he disappeared completely into the darkness.
"It's a beautiful theory, isn't it?"
said Sergei Andreevich, inhaling.
"One would almost think that you believe it,"
replied Yevgeny Dmitrievich cantankerously, scratching the cat behind the ear. Chapter 12. Police. Only one tunnel remained. Only one tunnel, and the goal given to him by Hunter towards which Artyom stubbornly and recklessly went would be reached. There were 2, maybe 3 kilometers left to go along a dry and quiet section, and he'd be there. An echoing silence prevailed in Artyom's head, a silence almost like that in the tunnel. But he no longer asked questions of himself. In another 40 minutes he'd be there. 40 minutes, and his trek would be over. He wasn't even aware that he was walking in impenetrable darkness. His legs continued to steadily mark off the ties. It was as if he had forgotten about all the dangers that threatened him, that he was unarmed, and that he had no identity papers, no flashlight, and no weapons, that he was dressed in an odd-looking set of loose overalls, and that finally he knew nothing about either this tunnel or the dangers that lay in wait for travelers through it. His conviction that nothing posed a threat to him as long as he was following his path filled him. Where had the seemingly inescapable fear of the tunnels gone? What had happened to his fatigue and lack of faith? The echo spoiled everything. Because this tunnel was so empty, the sound of his steps, carried both ahead and behind, reflected from the walls, they rumbled and gradually receded and passed into a rustle, and then echoed shortly after, so that it seemed Artyom was not walking in the tunnel alone. After some time, this perception became so acute that Artyom wanted to stop and listen and find out if the echo of his steps had a life of its own. He continued to struggle with temptation for several minutes. His pace became slower and quieter, and he listened to hear if this affected the loudness of the echo. Finally, Artyom stopped completely. He stood like that in the impenetrable darkness and waited, afraid to take a deep breath lest the sound of air entering his lungs interfered with the perception of the slightest murmurs in the distance. Silence. Now that he had stopped moving, his perception of the reality of space again vanished. While he was walking, it was as if he was grasping that reality by the soles of his boots. When he stopped in the middle of the ink-black darkness of the tunnel, Artyom suddenly no longer understood where he was, and it seemed to him when he again began to move that the barely perceptible echo of his steps reached his ears before his own foot managed to step down onto the concrete floor. His heart began to beat more acutely, but in an instant he was able to convince himself that paying attention to every rustle in the tunnels was silly and served no purpose. For some time, Artyom tried not to listen to the echo at all. Then, when it seemed to him that the most recent of the fading echoes were drawing closer, he covered his ears and continued to move forward. But even this didn't work for long. Removing his palms from his ears after a couple of minutes and continuing to walk, he heard, to his horror, the echo of his steps getting louder in front of him as if they were approaching. But all he had to do was stop, and so would the sounds in front of him, after a delay of some fraction of a second. The tunnel was testing Artyom and his ability to withstand fear, but he didn't give up. He'd already been through much too much to be scared by darkness and an echo. Was it an echo? It was getting closer. There was no doubt about that. Artyom stopped one last time when the phantom steps could be heard about 20 meters ahead of him. This was so inexplicable and weird that he couldn't stand it. He wiped the cold perspiration from his brow and, with his voice cracking, shouted into the emptiness, "Is anyone there?" The echo reverberated frighteningly close. and Artyom didn't recognize his own voice. The rolling echoes chased each other into the depths of the tunnels, shedding syllables.
Anyone there? One there? There?
And nobody answered. And suddenly something incredible happened. They started to come back, repeating his question, the dropped syllables recomposing themselves in reverse order and becoming louder, as though someone about 30 paces away had repeated his question in a frightened voice. Artyom could not endure this. Turning around, he went back, trying not to walk too fast at first, but then he ran, having completely forgotten about not encouraging his fears and stumbling. But after a minute, he understood that the reverberating footsteps continued to be heard at a distance of 20 meters. His invisible pursuer didn't want to let him go. Gasping, Artyom ran without understanding in what direction and finally collided with a tunnel cross-passage. The echo immediately evaded. Some time passed before he could gather up his willpower, get up, and take a step forward. It was the right direction. With each passing meter, the sound of steps shuffling against the concrete became closer, moving towards him, and only the blood pounding in his ears slightly suppressed the ominous rustling. Every time Artyom stopped, his pursuer stopped in the darkness as well, for Artyom was now absolutely sure it was no echo. This continued until the step sounded as close as one's outstretched arm, and then Artyom, yelling and blindly swinging his fists, sprang forward to where he reckoned the source of the steps had to be. His fists made a swishing sound as they cut through the emptiness. Nobody tried to defend themselves against his blows. He flailed the air uselessly, yelling, jumping back and moving his arms out from his sides in an effort to seize an enemy he could not see in the darkness. Emptiness. There was nobody there. But as soon as he caught his breath and made one more step toward Polis, he heard a heavy shuffling sound right in front of him. He again swung his arm, and again there was nothing. Artyom felt he was losing his mind. Straining his eyes until they hurt, he tried to see anything at all, and his ears tried to catch the nearby breathing of some other creature, but there simply wasn't anybody there. Having stood immobile for several long seconds, Artyom reflected that whatever the explanation might be for this strange phenomenon, it posed no danger to him. Acoustics, more than likely. "When I get home, I'll ask my stepfather," he said to himself. But when he had already brought his foot up to take another step toward his goal, someone quietly whispered directly in his ear,
"Wait, you can't go there now."
"Who's that? Who's there?" yelled Artyom, breathing heavily. But nobody answered. He was again surrounded by a deep emptiness. Then, wiping the sweat from his brow with the back of his hand, he hurried off in the direction of Borovitskaya. The phantom steps of his pursuer matched his pace as he moved in the opposite direction, gradually fading in the distance until they fell silent. And only then did Artyom stop. He did not and could not know what it had been. He had never heard of anything like it from any of his friends, nor had his stepfather spoken to him of it at night by the fire. But whoever it was, who whispered in his ear and ordered him to stop and wait, now, when Artyom no longer feared him, when he had the time to understand what had happened and do some hard thinking about it, it sounded hypothetically convincing. He spent the next 20 minutes sitting on the rails, swaying from side to side as if drunk, fighting the shakes and recalling the strange voice which belonged to no human that ordered him to wait. He moved forward only when the shivering finally began to pass, and the frightful whisper in his head had begun to merge with the quiet rush of the growing air current in the tunnel. From that point on, he simply walked forward, trying not to think of anything, stumbling at times over cables lying on the floor. But nothing more terrible happened to him. It seemed to him that not much time had passed, although he couldn't say how much, because the minutes all ran together in the darkness. And then he saw a light at the end of the tunnel. Borovitskaya. Polis. Then and there a rude cry was heard from the station, followed by the sound of shots, and Artyom, springing back, hid in a depression in the wall. From a distance he heard the lingering cries of the wounded, followed by foul language, and then there was the sound of another burst of automatic fire, amplified by the tunnel. Wait. Artyom ventured to emerge from his hiding place, only a full 15 minutes after everything had quietened down. Raising his arms, he walked slowly toward the light. This actually was an entry onto the platform. There was no watch on duty at Borovitskaya, apparently relying on the inviolability of pulleys. An access point made of concrete blocks stood 5 meters short of the point where the circular arches of the tunnel ended. A prone body lay next to it in a pool of blood. When Artyom emerged into the field of view of border guards wearing green uniforms and service caps, they ordered him to come closer and stand facing the wall. Seeing the body on the ground, he obeyed immediately. He was quickly searched, asked for his passport, had his arms twisted behind his back, and finally led to the station. Light. The very same. They told the truth. They always told the truth. Legends didn't lie. The light was so bright, Artyom had to squint so as not to be blinded. But the light entered his pupils, even through his eyelids, blinding him until it hurt, and only when the border guards blindfolded him did his eyes stop stinging. Returning to the life lived by previous generations of people turned out to be more painful than Artyom could imagine. The rag was removed from his eyes only at the guard shack, which looked like all others, a small office with walls of cracked tile. It was dark here. Only a candle flickered in an aluminium bowl that lay on an ochre-colored wooden table. The guard commander was a heavy-set, unshaven man in a green military shirt with rolled-up sleeves. He was wearing a tie on an elastic band. Collecting some of the liquid wax on his finger and observing how it cooled, he watched Artyom for a long time before asking,
"Where are you from? Where's your passport? What's with your eye?"
Artyom decided it didn't make sense to be devious, so he told the truth, that the passport had been left with the fascists, and that his eye had also almost remained there. The commander received this information with unexpected benevolence.
"Yeah, we know. That tunnel opposite comes out precisely at Chekhovskaya. We've got a whole fortress built there. There's no fighting for now, but some good folks tell us to keep our ears open, like they say, civis pacem, parabellum."
And he gave Artyom a wink. Artyom didn't understand the last part of what had been said, but preferred not to ask about it. His attention was attracted by the tattoo at the crook of the commander's elbow. It depicted a radiation-deformed bird with two heads, spread wings, and hooked talons. It dimly reminded him of something, but of what he had no idea. Later, when the commander turned to one of the soldiers, Artyom saw that the same image, smaller, had been tattooed on the commander's left temple.
"And why had you come here?"
continued the commander.
"I'm looking for someone. His name is Melnik. It's probably a nickname. I have an important message for him."
The expression on the face of the commander changed immediately. The idly benevolent smile left his lips, and his eyes sparkled with surprise in the light of the candle.
"You can't deliver it to me."
Artyom shook his head and, apologizing, started to explain that there was no way he could do that, that it was hush-hush, you understand, and that he had been strictly ordered to say nothing to anyone except this very same Melnik. The commander studied him one more time and signaled one of the soldiers, who handed him a black plastic telephone handset, together with a neatly coiled rubber-coated telephone cord of the required length. After dialing a number, the border guard spoke into the receiver.
"This is Postbor South. Ivashov, get me Colonel Melnik."
While he waited for an answer, Artyom managed to notice that both of the other soldiers in the room also had the bird tattoo on their temples.
"Who should I say is asking?"
asked the commander of Artyom, pressing the side of the handset to his chest.
"Say it's from Hunter. An urgent message."
The commander nodded and exchanged another couple of phrases with whoever was at the other end of the connection, then concluded the call.
"Be at Arbatskaya tomorrow morning at 9 at the station manager's office. You're free until then."
He signaled the soldier standing in the doorway, who immediately moved aside and then turned to Artyom and added,
"Wait a second. It would seem you are an honorary first-time guest of ours. So here, hang on to these, but don't forget to give them back."
He offered Artyom a pair of dark glasses and a shabby metal frame. "Not until tomorrow." Artyom was overcome by burning disappointment and resentment. This was why he came here, risking his own life and that of others. This was why he pressed on, forcing himself to move his feet, even when he had no strength left at all. And wasn't this an urgent business to report everything he knew to this so-and-so Melnik, who it turned out couldn't even find a spare minute for him? Or was it that Artyom was simply late, and Melnik already knew everything, or maybe Melnik already knows something that Artyom himself hasn't a clue about. Maybe he's so late that his entire mission no longer matters.
Not until tomorrow?
He burst out.
The colonel's on a mission today. He'll be back early in the morning, explained Ivashov. Get going, and you'll get some rest besides, he said, and saw Artyom out of the guard shack.
Having calmed down but still nursing a grievance, Artyom put on the glasses and thought they looked good, and they hid the shiner under his eye. The lenses were scratched, and moreover they distorted objects in the distance, but when he went out onto the platform after having thanked the border guards, he understood that he could not manage without them. The light from the mercury lamps was too bright for him. Besides, it wasn't just Artyom who couldn't open his eyes here. Many at the station hid their eyes behind dark glasses. They're probably also strangers, he thought. It was strange for him to see a fully illuminated metro station. There were absolutely no shadows here. At Vedyenka, as well as at all the other stations and substations where he had been up to now, there were few light sources, and they could not illuminate the entire space of what could be seen, and they only shed light on parts of it. There always remained places where not a single beam penetrated. Every person cast several shadows, one from a candle, withered and emaciated, a second from the emergency light, and a third, black and sharply defined, from an electric lantern. They mixed and covered each other in the shadows of others, sometimes coursing for several meters along the floor, startling you, deceiving you, and forcing you to guess and assume. Yet in Polis, every last shadow was eradicated in the ruthless glow of the daylight lamps. Artyom froze in his tracks, looking at Borovitskaya with delight. It remained in surprisingly good condition. Not a trace of soot was evident on the marble walls or white ceiling, and the station was tidy. A woman in light blue overalls labored over a time-blackened bronze panel at the end of the station, industriously scraping the bas-relief with a sponge and cleaning solution. The living accommodation here was arranged in the arches. Only two arches were left open at each end to access the tracks. The rest, bricked in from both sides, had been turned into real apartments. There was a doorway in each, and some even had wooden doors and glazed windows. The sound of music carried from one of them. Mats lay in front of several doors so that those entering could wipe their feet. This was the first time Artyom had seen anything of the kind. These quarters looked so cozy, so calm, that he felt a tightening in his chest, and a picture from his childhood suddenly appeared before his eyes. But what was most surprising was the chain of bookshelves that stretched along both walls the length of the entire station. They occupied the space between apartments, and this gave the entire station a kind of marvelous, strange look, reminding Artyom of descriptions he'd read of medieval libraries in a book by Borges. The escalators were at the far end of the hall, where the passage to the Arbatskaya station was located. The pressure doors remained open, but a small post was located at the passage. Then again, the guards let anyone who wanted to pass unhindered in both directions, without even checking documents. At the opposite end of the platform, on the other hand, next to the bronze bas-relief, there was a real military camp. Several green military tents were set up there, with markings drawn on them like the ones tattooed on the temples of the border guards. In the same place was a cart with some unknown weapon mounted on it, revealed by the long barrel with flared muzzle sticking out from under a cover. Nearby, two soldiers in dark green uniforms, helmets, and body armor were on duty. The camp encircled a passage stairway that ascended over the tracks. Flashing arrows indicated this was an exit to the city, whereupon the established precautions became clear to Artyom. A second stairway led to the same place and was completely blocked off by a wall of huge cement blocks. People dressed in long grey robes made of dense cloth sat at stout wooden tables that stood in the middle of the station. Drawing nearer to them, Artyom was surprised to see their temples were tattooed as well, but not with the image of a bird, but with that of an open book on a background of several vertical lines that bore a resemblance to a colonnade. Catching Artyom's intent look, one of the men seated at the table smiled amiably and asked, "Are you a newcomer? Is this your first time here?" Artyom flinched at the word newcomer, but pulled himself together and nodded. The man who had spoken was not much older than Artyom, and when he rose to shake Artyom's hand, working the flat of his hand out from the broad sleeve of the robe, it turned out they were of about the same height, only the man's physique was more delicate. Artyom's new acquaintance was called Daniel, He was in no hurry to talk about himself, and it was evident that he had decided to talk to Artyom because he was curious about what went on beyond the limits of police, about what was new on the ring, and about any news of the fascists and the Reds. In half an hour they were seated in the spindly Daniels home, in one of the apartments nestled between arches, and were drinking hot tea, certainly brought here by devious routes from Vedienche. Of the furniture in the room, there was a table piled with books, tall iron shelves that reached to the ceiling, also crammed to the top with thick volumes, and a bed. A weak electric bulb dangled from the ceiling on a wire, illuminating a skillfully executed drawing of an enormous ancient temple that Artyom did not immediately recognize as the library erected on the surface somewhere above Polis. After his host had run out of questions, it was Artyom's turn.
"Why do people here have tattoos on their heads?" he asked.
"What? Don't you know anything about castes?" said Daniel, surprised. "And you never heard of Polis Council?"
Artyom suddenly remembered that someone, no, how could he forget, it was that old man, Mikhail Porfirovich, who had been killed by the fascists, had told him that power in Polis was divided between the soldiers and the librarians because formerly the buildings of the library and some organization related to the army had stood on the surface.
"I've heard of it," he nodded.
"The warriors.
And librarians. So then you're a librarian?"
Daniel shot him a frightened glance, paled, and began to cough. After a while he pulled himself together and calmly said,
"What do you mean, librarian? Have you so much as seen a living librarian? I wouldn't recommend it. Librarians sit up above. You've seen our fortifications down here. Heaven forbid they come down. Don't ever confuse these things. I am not a librarian. I am a guardian. We are also called Brahmins."
"What kind of strange name is that?"
asked Artyom, raising his eyebrows.
"You see, we have something of a caste system here. Like in old India. A caste, well, it's like a class. Didn't the Reds explain that to you? Never mind. There's a caste of priests, or guardians of knowledge, those who collect books and work with them,"
he explained, while Artyom continued to marvel at how painstakingly he avoided the word librarian.
"And there's a warrior caste, of those who protect and defend. It's very similar to India, where there was also a caste of merchants and a caste of servants. We have all that, too. And we also use the Hindu names for them among ourselves. The priests are the Brahmins, the soldiers are the Kshatriyas, the merchants are the Vaishyas, and the servants are the Shudras. People become members of a caste once, and for the rest of their lives. There are special rites of passage, especially for Kshatriyas and Brahmins. In India, it was a tribal matter, ancestral, but with us it's something you choose yourself when you turn 18. Here at Borovitskaya, there are more Brahmins. In fact, almost everyone is a Brahmin. Our school is here, our libraries and cells. There are special conditions at the library because the red line crosses there, and it must be protected. And before the war, there were more of us there. Now they've moved to Aleksandrovsky Sad. Meanwhile, at Arabatskaya, it's nearly all Kshatriyas, because of the general staff."
Hearing yet another hissed ancient Indian word, Artyom sighed heavily. It was unlikely he'd remember all these difficult titles right off. However, Daniel did not pay attention to this and continued his narrative.
"Obviously, only two castes enter into the council, ours and the Kshatriyas, though as a matter of fact we just call them war doggies,"
he said to Artyom with a wink.
"So why do they tattoo two-headed birds on themselves?"
asked Artyom.
"You at least have books that make sense, but birds?"
"That's their totem," said Brahmin Daniel and shrugged. "I think that formerly it was a guardian spirit of the radiological defense forces. An eagle, I believe. After all, they believe in some strange thing of their own. Generally speaking, the castes around here don't get along particularly well. There was a time they even feuded."
Through the blinds they could see that the station lights had been dimmed. Local night was falling. Artyom started to gather his things.
"Is there a hotel where I can spend the night? Because I have a meeting tomorrow at 9 at Arbatskaya, and I have nowhere to stay."
"If you want, stay here,"
said Daniel, shrugging. I'll sleep on the floor, I'm used to it. I was just about to prepare dinner. Stay and you'll tell me what else you've seen along the road. Because, you know, I don't ever get away from this place. The guardian vows to not allow us to travel further than one station.
After thinking about it, Artyom nodded. It was comfortable and warm in the room, and Artyom had taken a liking to his host from the very beginning. They had something in common. In 15 minutes he was already cleaning mushrooms, while Daniel was cutting salt pork into small slices.
"Have you ever seen the library even once, with your own eyes?"
asked Artyom, his mouth full. They were eating stewed pork with mushrooms from aluminium mess dishes.
"You mean the Great Library?"
asked the Brahmin dourly.
"I mean the one up there. It's still there, right?"
said Artyom, pointing his fork at the ceiling.
"Only our elders go up into the Great Library, and the stalkers too, who work for the Brahmins," answered Daniel.
"So they're the ones who bring books down from above? From the library? I mean, from the Great Library?"
Artyom said, hurriedly correcting himself as he saw his host scowl once more.
"They do, but only by order of the caste elders. It is not within our power to do so ourselves, so we must use mercenaries,"
the Brahmin explained grudgingly.
"According to the testament, we should have been doing that, preserving knowledge and imparting it to seekers. But in order for knowledge to be imparted, it must first be obtained. Yet who among us will dare to go in there?"
he said, lifting his eyes upward with a sigh.
"Because of the radiation?"
said Artyom, comprehending.
"That too, but mainly because of the librarians," said Daniel in a subdued voice.
"But aren't you the librarians, or at least the descendants of the librarians? That's what I've heard."
"You know, let's not talk about this at the table. In fact, let someone else explain it to you. I don't like to talk about this subject, really."
Daniel started to clear the table, and then, after thinking for a moment, moved some books from a shelf off to the side, revealing a gap between the volumes standing in the back row in which a round-bellied bottle of moonshine gleamed. Table glasses were found among the dishware. After some time, Artyom, who had been examining the shelves with delight, decided to break the silence.
"Wow, you sure do have a lot of books," he said. "Over where we are at Vedienche, I don't think you could collect as many in the whole library. I finished reading them all a long time ago. It's rare that something good shows up. Only my stepfather brings anything worth reading, and the itinerant merchants bring nothing but miscellaneous rubbish in their suitcases, all sorts of detective novels. Half the time you can't tell what's going on in them anyway. That was another reason I dreamed of entering Polis, because of the Great Library. I just can't imagine how many there must be up there if they built such a huge place to keep them."
And he nodded towards the drawing over the table. The eyes of both of them were shining already. Daniel, flattered by Artyom's words, leaned over the table and said with great gravity,
"They don't mean a thing, all those books, and the Great Library was not built for them, and it's not books that are stored there."
Artyom looked at him with surprise. The Brahmin opened his mouth to continue, but suddenly rose from his chair, went to the door, cracked it open and listened. Then he quietly closed the door, sat back down, and whispered the rest of what he wanted to say.
"The entire Great Library was built for the one and only book, and it alone is hidden there. The rest are needed to help hide it. In reality, it is this book that is being sought, and it is being guarded,"
he added, and squirmed.
"What kind of book is it?"
asked Artyom, also lowering his voice.
"An ancient folio, a book of pages black as anthracite, where all of history is recorded in gold letters. To the end." "So why are people searching for it?"
whispered Artyom.
"You really don't understand,"
said the Brahmin, with a shake of his head.
"To the end means to the very end, and there's still some way to go before then. So whoever has this knowledge—"
A translucent shadow flashed behind the blinds, and Artyom, even though he was looking Daniel in the eye, noticed it and gave him a sign. Interrupting his tale in mid-sentence, Daniel jumped from his seat and darted to the door. Artyom bolted after him. There was nobody on the platform, but retreating footsteps could be heard from the direction of the passage. The sentries slept peacefully on chairs on both sides of the escalator. When they returned to the room, Artyom waited for the Brahmin to continue his story. But the latter had sobered up and only glumly shook his head.
"We're forbidden to relate this," he snapped. "That part of the testament is only for the initiated. The alcohol loosened my tongue," he said, wincing fretfully. "And don't even think of telling anyone what you heard. If it gets out to anyone that you know about the book, then there'll be no end of trouble for you. And for me, too."
And then Artyom suddenly understood why his palms had started sweating when the Brahmin had told him about the book. He remembered.
"But aren't there several of these books?"
he asked, his heart coming to a standstill. Daniel cautiously looked him in the eyes.
"What do you mean?"
"Fear the truths, hidden in ancient folios, in which the words are lettered in gold, and the viper black paper does not rot,"
he recited, while Bourbon's expressionless face loomed in a foggy haze before his eyes, mechanically uttering alien and incomprehensible words. The Brahmin stared at him fixedly in amazement.
"How do you know that?"
"A revelation. There's not just one book. What's in the others?"
asked Artyom, looking at the drawing of the library as if under a spell.
"Only one is left. There were three folios," said Daniel, surrendering finally. "The past, the present, and the future. The past and the present disappeared irrevocably centuries ago. Only the last and most important one remains. And where is it?" "Lost, somewhere in the main stack archives. There are more than 40 million volumes there. One of them a completely ordinary book by all appearances in a standard binding. Is it. To recognize it, you have to open the book and skim through it. According to legend, the pages of the folio actually are black, but you'd have to spend 70 years of your life without sleep or rest to skim through all the books in the main stack archive. Yet people can't stay there for more than a day. And second, nobody will let you stand around quietly and look through all the books that are stored there. And that's enough about that."
He laid some bedding on the floor, lit a candle on the table, and turned off the light. Artyom lay down unwillingly. For some reason, he didn't want to sleep at all, although he could not remember the last time that he managed to get some rest.
"I wonder, can you see the Kremlin when you go up to the library?"
he asked the emptiness, because Daniel had begun to fall asleep.
"Of course you can see it. Only you can't look at it. It draws you in,"
he muttered.
"What do you mean, it draws you in?"
Daniel lifted himself onto his elbows, and his face, knitted in displeasure, was illuminated by the yellow spot of light.
"The stalkers say that you can't look at the Kremlin when you go out, especially not at the stars and the towers. As soon as you look, you can't tear your eyes away. And if your gaze lingers for a while, the Kremlin starts to draw you inside. There's a reason all the gates stand wide open. That's why stalkers never go up into the great library by themselves. If one happens to glance at the Kremlin, the other will snap him out of it immediately." "What's inside the Kremlin?"
whispered Artyom, swallowing hard.
"Nobody knows. Because nobody who's ever gone in has ever come out again. Up there on the shelf, if you like, there's a book with an interesting history of stars and swastikas, including the ones on the Kremlin towers."
He got up, groped the book from the shelf, opened it to the correct page, and got back under his blanket. Daniel was asleep within a couple of minutes, but Artyom moved the candle closer and started to read.
"Being the smallest and least influential of political groups that fought for influence and power in Russia after the First Revolution, the Bolsheviks were not considered serious competitors by any of the opposing sides. They enjoyed no support from the peasantry and relied only on a small number of supporters among the working class and the navy, V.I. Lenin, who studied alchemy, and the invocation of spirits in secret Swiss schools, was able to find his principal allies on the other side of the barrier between worlds. It is precisely in this period that the pentagram emerges for the first time as the symbol of the communist movement within the Red Army. As is known, the pentagram is the most widespread and accessible portal between worlds for novices, allowing demons to enter our reality. At the same time, if the creator of a pentagram uses it skillfully, he can control the demons summoned into our world, and they must obey him. Normally, in order to better control a summoned creature, a protective perimeter is drawn around the pentagram, preventing the demon from escaping beyond the ring. It is not known how exactly the leaders of the communist movement were able to achieve that which the most powerful black magicians of all ages had sought, establishing links to the demon lords who commanded the obedience of hordes of their lesser brethren. Experts are convinced that the lords themselves, sensing the forthcoming war and the most horrible bloodshed ever in the history of mankind, drew nearer to the boundary between worlds and summoned those who could permit them to collect a harvest of human lives. In exchange, they promised support and protection. The story of how the Bolshevik leadership was funded by German intelligence is true, to be sure, but it would be foolish and superficial to believe that it was only thanks to his foreign partners that V.I. Lenin and his comrades in arms were able to tip the scales in their favor. Even then, the future communist leader had protectors who were immeasurably more powerful and wiser than the military intelligence officials in the Kaiser's Germany. Naturally, the details of the secret compact with the powers of darkness are not accessible to modern researchers. However, their result is clear. After a short time, pentagrams appear on banners, on the headgear of Red Army soldiers, and on the armor of its still sparse military equipment. Each of them opened a gate into our world to a demon protector who guarded the wearer of the pentagram from external violence. The demons received their pay, as usual, in blood. In the 20th century alone, according to the most conservative estimates, around 30 million inhabitants of the country were sacrificed. The compact with the lords of the summoned powers quickly justified itself. The Bolsheviks seized and consolidated power, and although Lenin himself, who had been the intermediary between the two worlds, could not endure, and died only 54 years after his birth, eaten from within by the fires of hell, his followers unhesitatingly continued his work. Soon after followed the demonization of the entire country. School children pinned their first pentagram to their chests. Few know that from the outset, the ritual of initiation into the little Octoberists intended the badge's pin to be used to pierce the child's skin. The demon of the little Octoberist star would thus taste the blood of its future host, entering into a sacral union with its host once and forever. Growing up and becoming a pioneer, the child would receive a new pentagram, and a part of the essence of the compact would be revealed to those experiencing insight. A gold-imprinted portrait of the leader was wrapped in flames in which he disappeared. Thus, the rising generation was reminded of the heroic deed of self-sacrifice. After that was the Komsomol, and finally, the way was cleared for the chosen to enter into the priestly caste, the Communist Party. Myriads of summoned spirits protected everyone and everything in the Soviet state, children and adults, buildings and equipment, while the demon lords themselves took up residence in the giant ruby pentagrams on the Kremlin towers, willingly agreeing to confinement for the sake of their increased power. It was precisely from here that invisible lines of force spread over the entire country, holding it back from chaos and collapse, and subordinating its inhabitants to the will of those who occupied the Kremlin. In some sense, the entire Soviet Union was turned into one giant pentagram whose surrounding protective perimeter became its national boundary. Artyom tore himself away from the page and looked around. The candle had burned down and had started to smoke. Daniel was sound asleep, with his face turned to the wall. Artyom stretched, and then returned to the book. The supreme test for Soviet power became the clash with National Socialist Germany. Protected by powers no less ancient or powerful than was the Soviet Union, the armor-fettered Teutons were able to penetrate deeply into our country for the second time
in 1,000 years. This time their banners were inscribed with a reversed symbol of the sun, light, and prosperity. To this very day, 50 years after the victory, tanks with pentagrams on their turrets continue in perpetual battle against tanks whose steel bears the swastika.